Lecture 26, The British Raj and Early Nationalism.
British colonial rule over India, that is the British Raj, lasted for almost 90 years until 1947. During that period of high colonialism, many British men and women worked to create institutions that would control this crown jewel of the empire. But these very institutions of colonial rule created conditions that led a growing number of Indian men and women to strive for their own nation. There was much heated debate on all sides about this process and about the nature of the nation or nations that would emerge out of colonialism. In this lecture, we'll begin by surveying the structure of British colonial rule over India as it changed during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. We'll also see how various competing Indian nationalist movements began to develop during this same period. In future lectures, we'll look at the careers and visions of some leading anti-colonial nationalists, including Mohandas Mahatma Gandhi, and rival leaders. The British Raj emerged from the aftermath of the desperate and brutal fighting of 1857-58, termed variously the Indian Mutiny, First War for Indian Independence, or People's Uprising. This bloody conflict in India, the 1865 Morant Bay Rebellion in Jamaica, and the Maori Wars in New Zealand between 1845 and 72 solidified British ideas about race as being biological and immutable. These resonated with Charles Darwin's evolutionary ideas about the survival of the fittest. According to the theory of social evolution, since Britain had conquered India and Indians, the reasoning went, it must be morally and racially fitter. Many officers and officials of the British Raj tried to institutionalize what they considered British racial and social superiority. Recall that after 1857, an array of new British policies developed that were designed to prevent the recurrence of sepoy mutiny and armed popular rebellion. The British Indian Army replaced the three East India Company armies. This British Indian Army became the major imperial armed force, expanding and defending the British Empire in China, Southeast Asia, East Africa, the Middle East, and even Europe. Remember that this new British Indian Army used new recruiting processes based on the supposed race, recruiting Indian so-called martial races, including Muslims and Indian communities that had remained loyal to the British, like Sikhs and Gurkhas. The sharply marked distinction between white British commissioned officers and non-white Indian non-commissioned officers and sepoys continued. In the civil service, the British instituted similar racially based patterns. After 1858, the white British officials of the East India Company became the Indian Civil Service, which powerfully administered the two-thirds of India under direct British rule. The ICS also indirectly ruled the hundreds of Indian princely states that collectively comprised the other third of India. As critics have ironically put it, the Indian Civil Service was none of the above. First, the ICS was in India, but mostly not Indian. Until the late 19th century, the ICS was almost all white British, mostly born in Britain and later retiring there. Starting in 1863, very few Indian highly anglicized young men traveled to London in order to take the ICS entrance examination. Legally, there was no racial bar to any man taking that examination. But British officials made it very difficult for Indians even to take the exam. Not only was the examination in English, it was also in Western subjects, including English, Greek, Latin, Italian, French, and German languages and literatures. Further, it was only offered in London, so Indian candidates had to travel there and take it in an unfamiliar place. Making it even more difficult, the age limit was dropped to 19 in 1878. One Indian candidate, Surendranath Banerjee, passed the exam but was failed for poor horsemanship. He went on to be a prominent Indian nationalist politician. those early Indians who managed to overcome all these hurdles and gain entry were often ostracized by their white colleagues. By 1900, only 11 Indians had successfully joined. Indeed, until World War I, Indians remained just a smaller proportion. Only with the massive deaths during that war of young British men did the percentage of Indians begin to rise. But they were only just over half in 1947. Second, although civil in Indian civil service officially meant civilian rather than military, the ICS officers were authoritarian rather than civil or polite to most Indians, or even to British merchants, missionaries, or other Europeans outside the officialdom of the British Raj. Instead, the members of the ICS openly referred to themselves as the heaven-born. They evoked Plato's concept of the guardians, a golden ruling class of philosopher kings, superior to and separate from those they governed. Third, rather than serve India, the Indian civil service dominated it and claimed to speak for it. They took pride in being the steel frame of the British Raj. Jawaharlal Nehru called them the world's most tenacious trade union in that they refused to be questioned and saw their own exclusive interests as overriding everyone else's. The ICS even resented and often resisted the policies of the British viceroy, their official boss. He was usually a British politician who arrived unfamiliar with India, usually presiding for only 1 5-year term there, and then left. In contrast, the members of the ICS saw themselves as old India hands, who really knew the country and people better, in fact, than Indians knew themselves. Indeed, many members of the ICS saw themselves as protecting the simple, childlike Indian peasant and much abused Indian women against the morally suspect Indian middle-class men who were allegedly constantly exploiting them. These career ICS officials took great pride in modernizing India, at least in terms of technology. Telegraphs had begun to transform communication. Telegraphs totaled about 4,500 miles by the mid-19th century, and telegraph lines continued to spread rapidly. By 1865, there was even a mostly undersea cable between India and Britain. Further, British-owned railways spread across India, going from 5,000 miles in 1872 to 25,000 miles by 1900, and then 40,000 miles by 1930. These railways were not intended to develop Indian industry. Rather, they were to take India's surplus agricultural production to the ports of Bombay, Calcutta, and Madras for transshipment overseas to Britain. Indian raw cotton, for example, went to cloth factories in the British Midlands. These railway tracks also carried ever more British manufactured products like finished cloth to Indian markets. Growing numbers of Indians also traveled as train passengers. This railway system transformed Indian concepts of time, as it did around the world, by fixing strict timetables and one time zone for all of India. But the trains also had separate classes, with first-class compartments almost always exclusively white, and with second and third classes for different types of Indians. Railway stations also reinforced racial separations, with distinct stations primarily for serving Britons versus those serving Indians. In many cities, the berm on which the railway line sat also divided the black and the white sections of the city. Plus, the railways were built by private British corporations who were guaranteed a profit of 4.5 or 5% on their investment. Almost all the railway equipment was built in Britain, creating jobs and profits there. British-designed irrigation canals transformed agriculture in many regions, particularly the previously arid Punjab and Sindh within the Indus River basin. The British allocated the newly irrigated lands according to their social engineering goals, rewarding those castes and men who supported the Raj. Continued control over water distribution then gave the British Raj power over the lives of those farmers. many Britons believed that these massive civil engineering projects of railways and long-distance canals was proof that science and nature had both been mastered by British civilization. The British started taking a complete national census across India in 1871 and repeated it every 10 years. This gave them extensive knowledge about the numbers of Indians in each district, city, and village. But the census also created fixed categories of religion and caste into which Indians had to fit. Once recorded, this identity could not easily be changed. The British then used these categories for their own government purposes. For example, in the Punjab, the British wanted to protect so-called traditional peasant castes from exploitation by Indian merchants and moneylenders. So under the Alienation of Land Act of 1900, only members of legally agricultural castes could purchase land. Thus, which castes were officially classified as agricultural had many unexpected effects on people's lives. A member of the ICS was a generalist rather than a technocrat. He might, over his career, be posted for a time to the central administration, for example, in the revenue department. Next, he might serve as a political agent guiding a prince. Then, he might govern a rural area where, in most districts, he combined the executive, judicial, and financial authority in himself alone. In effect, there was no practical way for Indians under his authority to appeal his decisions. Plus, the Punjab, for example, was a non-regulation province. This meant that each ICS officer there governed his district largely on the basis of his own judgment, with no formal set of regulations to constrain him. Yet, even by the time the British Raj ended, there were only 980 members of the Indian Civil Service, while the total Indian population was about 390 million. This was a ratio of nearly 400,000 subjects for every one ICS man, and the ICS was always male. Therefore, much of the actual work of administration was necessarily in the hands of Indian subordinates and intermediaries. These were the very classes that the ICS both distrusted and also necessarily had to work through. Below the ICS were various subordinate civil services, including the police, public works department, and the postal service. Some services, like the railways, were where people of mixed ancestry, so-called Anglo-Indians, concentrated, being largely excluded from the superior ICS. All these other services worked under the commanding supervision of the local ICS officer. Plus, under the ICS and the British officers of these new subordinate services were uncovenanted officers. The vast majority of these people were Indians, comparable to non-commissioned officers in the British Indian Army. Just as in the British Indian Army, the most junior, inexperienced white British man gave orders to the most senior, experienced, non-commissioned Indian officer, the same was true of the ICS and these uncovenanted officials. Nor could someone get promoted into the ICS from below. Really, these were separate corps identified by race. Working under the uncovenanted officials were tens of thousands of hired Indian clerks, servants, and laborers. They had no job security and usually very low pay. It was hard for Indians in government employment to get involved in social reform or politics since they depended on the British approval for their jobs. Instead, many of the earliest Indian leaders came from the professional classes who worked with but not for the British Raj, as lawyers, for example. Many social reformers and early Indian nationalists had an anglicized education, either in India or, more rarely, in Britain. As you'll recall, from the 1830s onward, British colonial government-sponsored education was Anglophone, and that allowed Indian men who were elites to study subjects like English literature, English history, and Western-style science. A few of the more enterprising Indian elite families began, from the early 19th century onward, to send their sons to England itself for higher education. Wherever they studied, these young men were taught about the superiority of British culture and England's tradition of liberty and democracy. But gradually, some of these anglicized Indians began to question the discrepancy between British humanistic ideals and the exploitative practices of colonialism. Jawaharlal Nehru articulated this as the two Englands. He distinguished between, quote, the England of Shakespeare and Milton, of noble speech and writing and brave deed, of political revolution and the struggle for freedom, of science and technological progress, and the England of the savage penal code and brutal behavior of entrenched feudalism and reaction, close quote. He then asked rhetorically, which of these two Englands came to India? Domestically, in Britain, the middle classes had led a humanistic and democratic social revolution. While they were in Britain, Indian men might socialize with their British classmates or even date British women of their own social class or lower. But in Britain's Indian and African colonies, preserving racial separation was vital. So the values of England's old repressive aristocracy prevailed. Many Indians and Britons wrote about how on the shipboard passage to India, racial separatism began to be socially enforced by Britons as the vessel steamed east of Suez. The humanistic England gave way to the arrogant, imperializing England. Much of the focus of racial separation in India surrounded the small but growing number of British women there. Since so many British men were off in the colonies, there was a real shortage of husbands available in Britain. So at the start of the cooler season in India, shiploads of young British women arrived, known as fishing fleets. They had a brief period to find a husband, usually from among the pool of senior British men who earned enough savings to support a wife, and enough seniority to get leave during that period. Ideally, the engagement and wedding would take place before the hot season began again. Many pregnant young brides went home to give birth in Britain. There, the sons would get a good English education before joining the ICS like their fathers. Given the age difference, the father might retire to Britain just as his son was going out to India. By the late 19th century, various Indian people began increasingly to challenge the permanence of the British Raj and its racial segregation. In 1885, about 70 Indian anglicized elite men from all over India came together in Bombay for what was called an Indian National Congress. Although many Americans think of a Congress as a legislature rather than a movement or political party, this was really just a voluntary convention. The African National Congress movement and then political party later took its name from this Indian National Congress. The man who organized the general invitation in 1885 was Alan Octavian Hume, a British former ICS official who believed that Indians should begin to play a larger role in governing India. Hume had actually been pushed out from the ICS for his relatively liberal views. The Indians who assembled in 1885 substantially began to see their nationality and their shared interests for the first time. There had earlier been scattered discussions about a possible nation, but hitherto mostly confined within specific provinces. For example, Calcutta-based middle and upper-class Bengalis had been developing the sense of their own culture and of a Bengali nation since the early 19th century. Calcutta was the imperial capital of the British Raj, so politicians there had direct ways to influence the government, even if they could not directly participate in it. Likewise, elite Marathi speakers around Bombay began to organize themselves around their own cultural and national identity. Most regions were also standardizing their regional vernacular languages, with the increasing publication in many of those languages of newspapers, pamphlets, and books, including novels, which often provided models for self-improvement. Literacy was still limited, especially for women. But there were growing public discourse communities, especially within provinces. in many regions, Hinduism was the major provider of powerful symbols. The Bengali hymn Vande Mataram, meaning Hail the Mother Goddess, became a statement of national pride there. Similarly, Hindus in Bombay celebrated the Maratha war hero Shivaji, whom I discussed in a previous lecture. But in 1885, men from many provinces began to speak of one of another as collectively Indians. Many nationalist leaders were well-established lawyers and other professionals, often Brahmins or members of other high Hindu castes. Some of the early leaders were Parsis from Bombay. As you recall from an earlier lecture, Parsis are a small minority, but they had been among the earliest and most successful Anglicizers. Since no single language is shared among India's various regions, English was the common link language among them. With that came English concepts like formal resolutions. The early meetings of the Indian National Congress passed a few resolutions, but these were all intended to contribute to the British Raj, not end it. Resolutions included the opportunity to take the ICS exam in India so more Indians could serve the British monarch. But the Viceroy declined to implement any of these resolutions. Nonetheless, the Indian National Congress continued to meet annually in one Indian city or another. In 1890, the Congress resolved to meet 2 years later in London, where it could lobby British parliamentarians directly. But this never happened, largely because British politicians did not want Indians to have one organized voice in the British imperial capital. Since the Indian National Congress proposals were quite general about what the Indian nation would be, elite men of various communities participated. One Parsi leader, Dadabhai Narojji, spent many years in England as a merchant and part-time teacher of his native language, Gujarati, at University College London. He also participated in British politics, actually winning a seat in the British Parliament in 1892. One of Narojji's insights was how Britain had long been draining India of its capital, thereby funding the British Industrial Revolution while stunting Indian development. So Narojji brought to the Indian National Congress great insights into British political processes. There were also a few Anglicized Indian Muslims who participated, most notably Muhammad Ali Jinnah, whom I'll discuss in depth in a later lecture. Gradually, some of the younger, more assertive men in the Indian National Congress began to push more strongly for changes in the Raj. They were termed extremists, although their proposals were not really very radical. This led to an open split in the Indian National Congress in its 1907 meeting in Surat over just how self-governing India should be in the future. Many British policymakers resented even these modest assertions by the Indian National Congress and other Indian leaders. Calcutta, in particular, was a major center for Indian Hindu leadership, especially men who were enriched by the permanent settlement of 1793. So in 1905, the British Raj divided Bengal presidency. The official reason was administrative convenience, but the effect was to separate these Calcutta-based Hindu nationalists from the political resources of their landed estates in East Bengal. Further, Bengalis became a cultural minority in their much reduced province of Bengal, since Biharis and Oriyas outnumbered them in it. Conversely, in the new province of eastern Bengal, the large majority of the population was Muslim. This split had intentionally opened up a protected political space for Muslim leaders. Indeed, in eastern Bengal, a new political party was organized, the Muslim League, in 1906. Many of its leaders were major landlords who claimed to be speaking for their Muslim tenants. Thus, the British Raj's policy of divide and rule led to a second major elite voice along with the Indian National Congress that was the Muslim League. Its leaders wanted British protection from the Hindu majority. Further encouraging Muslim separatism, the Raj instituted separate electorates for Muslims, where only Muslims could vote and only a Muslim candidate could be elected. These were initially local and provincial level elections with a very limited franchise. But separate electorates for Muslims continued until the end of the British Raj. Early efforts by Jinnah and other leaders to ally the Indian National Congress and the Muslim League failed within a few decades. The 1905 partition of Bengal, however, mobilized people far more widely than the British had anticipated. These rising Indian leaders used the concept of Swadeshi, meaning of one's own land. That is, only products made in India should be purchased. In 1911, the British Raj reversed this partition of Bengal, although the British would repeat it again in 1947. But the British deprived the Calcutta-based politicians of their direct influence over the imperial government by shifting the capital to New Delhi. As a symbol of an eternal British Raj, they built a planned new city adjacent to the old Mughal capital of Shahjahanabad, now renamed Old Delhi. So instead of Bengalis in Calcutta, now North Indians in the region around Delhi, including many Muslim leaders there, had direct influence over the colonial government. Britain declared war on Germany in 1914, declaring India at war too. The British government did not consult Indians, but expected them to pour their manpower and resources into the war effort. This forced many Indian nationalist politicians to decide whether they had a moral duty to support the empire when it went to war. Many, including Mohandas Gandhi, did so, since they were demanding the rights due to citizens of the British Empire, and therefore felt that they were obliged to defend it. So Gandhi and some other Indian leaders encouraged the recruitment of Indian soldiers to go fight in Europe. In all, about 1.7 million Indian soldiers, plus many military laborers, volunteered to support the British. This was nearly 20% of the entire global British Imperial Army. These Indians fought in Europe and the Middle East, where recruitment came widely across India, thereby discrediting the British pretense that there were martial and effeminate Indian races. Further, many more Indians became officers, taking on more authority since there were fewer white British officers available. During World War I, the much expanded need for Indian manpower forced the British to make compromises in imperial control. The number of white British troops garrisoned in India declined, since they were needed in the trenches of Europe. This loosened the British coercive presence in India. Additionally, large numbers of Indian men got military training and experience in battle fighting as equals against white Europeans. Many also fraternized with white European men and women. All this made them question British claims of racial superiority. Many Indians suffered during this First World War. More than 130,000 Indian soldiers were either killed or wounded. The Indian economy was also greatly affected as it supplied food, clothing, and money to desperate England. The British rhetoric designed to mobilize popular support for the war, calling it a war for democracy, encouraged many Indians to expect it for themselves, as did the promises by President Woodrow Wilson about post-war national self-determination. So at the armistice, many Indians had a growing sense that they had earned self-government, at least if not total independence. But many British politicians wanted instead to return to a renewed British Raj in India. Instead of rewarding India, the British Raj put into place continued restrictions like the Rowlatt Acts of 1919, which authorized arrest and detention without trial. Other brutal British actions included the Jallianwala Bagh massacre in the Punjab. In the city of Amritsar, nearly 400 innocent Indians were killed and another 1,100 seriously wounded when British General Dyer ordered them shot in a confined square without being given the chance to disperse. So during the interwar years, many more Indians got involved in politics due to British acts of coercion, as well as developing Indian leadership. Many Indian leaders heightened their demands for self-rule and eventually independence. British efforts to provide small sops repeatedly proved inadequate. As we'll discuss in the next lectures, a range of Indian leaders arose who mobilized different constituencies around different models for the nation to come. By the time of World War II, India had moved much closer to independence. This war repeated in an ever more powerful ways some of the processes of the earlier World War. This time, about 2.5 million Indian soldiers joined the British Indian Army, which expanded to 10 times its pre-war size. A few Indians were able to become commissioned officers. These Indian forces fought in Europe as well as in Asia, defending the British Empire. Indian taxpayers also contributed greatly by choice or compulsion. Distressed Britain barely saved itself and could no longer hold on to India or its many other widespread colonies. So independence came in 1947, but the bitter conflicts over the shape of the nation or nations that emerged would continue.